No matter how often we talk about our Wisconsin wildlife, you know, there's always something new to talk about. And the cold and early start to winter and the wildlife around us definitely noticing that as well. We can visit about that with our two wildlife specialists. I'm Larry Mueller, by the way. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Our wildlife specialist, David Drake, with UW Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, one of our guests. David, great to have you back.
Well, Larry, thank you for having me back.
And Jamie Knack. Jamie is the Wildlife Outreach Specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Jamie, you're always welcome on this program.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be back.
Oh, well, great to have you with us. And there's so many things we can talk about today. The deer season just concluded. I have a photo, which I should post it. I don't know why I haven't posted it yet on my Facebook page, but there is a photo of some turkeys on my back lawn, which is in Madison, and they went to pay a visit to Margaret, the plastic turkey decoy that I have sitting in the backyard.
And that may be why you have turkeys, Larry.
And wandering around, there's a half a dozen, six or seven of them in our neighborhood. So there's a, you know, people are saying, oh, this is a lot of fun to have all these turkeys, and it is. There's a lot of wildlife in our city limits anymore. Not only Madison, but all over the place. Jamie?
Yeah, there definitely is. And it's really fun to have that wildlife and have those close encounters and be able to enjoy seeing them. And I think we'll talk a little bit here, but about, you know, when the wildlife get a little too close or how we should behave amongst the wildlife. So in terms of not feeding them, and maybe, David, you want to talk about some of the recent issues with turkeys being a little bit more aggressive than some people have desired?
Yeah, so turkeys are an interesting species. And one of the things we are finding, I think, in the wildlife profession is that there's quite a few species of wildlife that are adapting to living in what we call human-dominated landscapes, or those urbanized areas that humans live in as well. And turkeys is a great example of that. And I, you know, I'm almost 50 years old, and the generation before me, when they were being taught about turkey management in wildlife school, that the general thought was that turkeys need a lot of unbroken contiguous habitat with, you know, some forested areas mixed with some open areas and things like that. And they don't do really well around urbanization. And then when I started coming up through graduate school and wildlife school, it was that they can live in they don't need as much contiguous land, but they can still live around some people. And now we're teaching our students that turkeys are an urban species, or can be an urban species. And as you mentioned about your lawn in Madison, not too long ago I was driving down Regent Street, which is a very busy street here in Madison, and I actually had to stop my truck in mid-afternoon to let three turkeys go across the street. And so it is wonderful to see them here, and there's a lot of wonderful resources for the turkeys. They get a lot of food here. There's some safety from predators and things like that. So they've got a pretty good life in these human-dominated landscapes. But it does create some issues as well, especially in the spring when the toms or the males are surging with hormones in their bodies. They get pretty aggressive, and they seem to take a lot of their aggression out for some reason on male carriers in particular, but others as well. And so we get a lot of calls, especially in the spring, about what to do about aggressive turkeys, and we talk about that. But, you know, as Jamie mentioned, there's a lot of people in the urban area, and unfortunately, as has been documented through Richard Louv and the nature deficit disorder and things like that, a lot of people aren't spending as much time out of doors as previous generations. And so when they encounter these species up close and personal, instead of looking at it in awe and kind of looking at it with some remarkable incredulity about it, that people a lot of times instead are the first reaction is, oh my gosh, there's something scary out there and we need to do something about it to get rid of it. And that's not necessarily the case. So we're trying to both educate the public about what to do in case we have negative wildlife encounters, which there can be some aggression with wildlife, but we also are trying to teach people what they can do for positive encounters, and also make sure that they're maximizing as much habitat in their yards, because that's a really wasted space that wildlife could use, or we could do more for wildlife in people's yards. And so it is a really fun thing. But, you know, we talk about turkeys. Bobcat have been seen in Wisconsin, in Madison now, fox, coyote. And that's the case, you know, not just in Madison, but in urbanized areas around the country. So
it's remarkable. The bobcat.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. So they had a bobcat spotted over on the UW Arboretum property on a couple different times.
Okay. And the fox, we had fox a Fox family on the UW-Madison campus.
Yep.
How are those?
They're doing pretty well.
I haven't seen them lately.
Yeah, we should start seeing them a little bit more often now because they'll start getting tied to the den site here pretty soon. Mm-hmm. And then they'll be seen more regularly in certain locations. But we've had reports of fox getting killed by vehicles here on campus and around in the Madison area, which is not to be unexpected. And so the population is still doing well, and we're looking forward to seeing what happens this coming breeding season. We're going to continue to study the fox here on campus, as well as in areas of Madison and the coyotes, and we're hoping to put out 30 more radio collars on coyotes and 30 more radio collars in red fox in Madison this coming winter. So we should have a lot more information to report as the year goes on.
And, of course, the deer and the geese have been here forever, it seems like, almost, Jamie.
Yeah, I mean, we've had urban deer, urban geese for a very, very long time in dealing with those. You know, again, the very positive encounters that occur with that, but also some of the, you know, nuisances in terms of parks and Warner Park and the different municipalities that deal with, you know, urban geese and deer over-browsing and so on.
And anything we should keep in mind to make sure that we don't harm these wildlife, or is there other than what we've talked about already?
Yeah, so I think there's some, you know, certainly things as you're driving, we've passed the deer rut right now, but there's a lot of wildlife vehicle collisions, not just with deer, but with geese and turkey and, you know, groundhogs when they're up and about and other animals like that. So just be careful when you're driving. And obviously in those urbanized areas, there's a higher density of road networks. There have been documentations with secondary poisoning. So if you're using rodenticides, for example, to try to control mouse or ground squirrel or chipmunk populations, other animals that scavenge on dead animals and other animals that predate or feed on some of these small mammals, that they will catch those animals, and then that poison transfers to the predator. And I've had a friend of mine in L.A. who's done some work with coyotes and bobcats out there. And he's actually published some papers looking at secondary poisoning that coyotes have caught enough rodents with rodenticide in them that the coyotes have actually what's called bleeding out, where that rodenticide has actually killed some of these top predators. So you want to be really careful about that. You know, it's the usual window collisions with birds and things of that nature. But there are, if you can just be a little bit thoughtful about making sure you're taking care of the wildlife out there, trying to provide as much food, water, and shelter resources as you can in your yard, that would be very, very beneficial. And just enjoy, when you encounter wildlife, enjoy it.
Yeah. Actually, talking with David Drake and Jamie Nack today from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, taking a look at the world of wildlife. And I haven't given the number yet, so let me do that right now. If you have a question or comment or maybe a wildlife experience to share, I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page's title is The Larry Mueller Show. And if you want to join the Facebook page, we'd certainly always love to have you join. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can click like, and we'll send you regular updates and all kinds of good things. So that's how you get to talk with us, and I hope you'll do that as we go along. I wanted to mention the gun deer season there. I finally now some numbers out, and really the numbers are down, Jamie, from previous years.
The state just issued their press release with their preliminary numbers, and it's important to acknowledge that these are preliminary. They will continue to get call-around information to over 600 deer registration stations across the state, so the biologists will be calling in that information, and we'll see these numbers go up slightly, but the trend is going to be similar to preliminary numbers last year. So our harvest figures for the nine-day gun deer season, 191,550 deer harvested. And the overall buck harvest of about 90,000 animals was down 8% from last year. So that's something we can compare from buck harvest this year to buck harvest last year. Yes, that was slightly down. But we also are seeing that same trend in terms of overall reduction of the harvest and also buck harvest according as well. it has been similar to other states. So Minnesota, Illinois, Iowa, their harvest numbers for this year have also dropped. For Wisconsin, some of this has been very intentional. So especially the antlerless harvest, there were no antlerless harvest in the north. And that was, again, designed to help rebuild the herds in the north where we're coming off of two long and fairly harsh winters. So I guess one other thing I'd really like to highlight about the 9-day gun deer season is it has been the safest deer season on record. So there were 3 confirmed shooting related incidents that were reported. And this is since, typically long time ago, we'd have injuries and incidents in the double digits. But there's been over 1 million hunters that have attended a hunter education course in the state since 1967, learning about firearm safety rules. And
so that's been pretty good.
Very good. That's the lowest number of incidents we've had for the 9-day gun deer season.
And I did not see the nature of those. Were those self-inflicted?
Self-inflicted. I think one was probably would be considered on a drive, and the other two, I believe, were self-inflicted.
Okay.
So, and those include firearm related. They wouldn't include
fell out of the tree stand.
Tree stand, heart attack, and I haven't heard any discussion on those or anything. But
okay, all right. Well, we have callers online with questions for you guys, so maybe we should go there. Mary in New Berlin, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning. I have a question about a coyote. I have 2 St. Bernards, and I have a coyote that stalks us. It stalks us at 10 o'clock at night. It's out at 4 o'clock in the morning. It's around at 7 in the morning. And my dogs chased it one night, and they came back to me, luckily. And I grabbed them, and we started walking back on the lawn, back up to the house, and gol darn it, the coyote followed us.
Mary, I think it was just trying to say hi.
One morning around 4, it came again. In fact, that time there were 2 of them. And I got to a safe spot, and I hollered at it, and it didn't move. It just looked at me and kept coming toward me. When I did holler at it again, it just stopped, looked at me, and eventually just sauntered away. No running or anything.
Well, so a couple of things that are probably going on, Mary. One thing is coyotes are related to your St. Bernard, so they're all in the canid family or the dog family. And the coyotes obviously are wild dogs. Your St. Bernard's a domesticated dog, but the coyotes, as with all dogs, they are a little bit territorial. And so when another dog is in their area, they want to know what that dog is doing and why it's there. And so that's probably one of the reasons the coyotes were following you with your dogs, is just out of curiosity to see what's going on in their territory, their home range. But the other thing that happens with urban wildlife, and this is a great example with the coyotes, we see this with fox a lot as well, is that these animals become what's called habituated to humans and to other domestic pets. And by that, what I mean is when they are spend a lot of time around humans and nothing bad happens to them every time they're around human beings, they get more and more bold, or they get more used to being around human beings, and they lose their fear of us. And as that occurs, then, as they habituate, they get closer and closer to us, or they are seen during the day, for example, around people when normally they wouldn't be if they were getting more fearful of human beings. So it doesn't mean that they're doing anything wrong or they intend harm to you, your St. Bernards. It's just that they're curious, and nothing bad has happened to them anytime they're around human beings. So the best thing that you can do for your safety, for your dog's safety, and for the coyote's welfare is to make those coyotes as scared of you as possible. So when you see them, maybe throw some stones at them. You know, you don't want to necessarily hurt them, but just throw some stones or sticks at them. Yell, raise your arms, and make big noises and big movements and try to scare them out of the area just to try to put some more fear into them.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. Or have something that makes a loud noise.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, if you have some kind of a noise making device that's not going to disturb your neighbors at 10 at night, try that as well.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Mary. Appreciate your call. Visiting today with David Drake and Jamie Knack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, taking a look at the world of wildlife today with David Drake and Jamie Knack. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening in. Question or comment, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. If you got a great wildlife photo and question, you can post it on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page is The Larry Mueller Show. Or you can also email us with a question or comment at talk@wpr.org. Dan in Cazenovia up next with a comment. Hi, Dan. Thank you for calling.
Well, hi, Larry. I'm really happy to be on. I have a story about about bald eagles up here in Vernon County.
Cool.
I have an office up in Hillsboro and overlooks a little lake up there, and I'd often see the bald eagles jump feet first right out of trees straight into the water and grab fish and swim to the shore with them, which is pretty cool. But one day, I was looking out the window working with a patient, and lo and behold, this bald eagle swooped down in a little yard in front of me and grabbed a feral cat and flew off across the lake with a tail hanging between its legs. I'd never seen anything like it in my life. And I know you often say, no, bald eagles don't eat pets, and sorry if this upsets people, but it happened right in front of my eyes.
Interesting. Well, I've seen hawks take baby rabbits.
Yeah.
And I don't know, Jamie, a comment?
Yeah,
from
you know, we've had these questions. There's been a story that's been perpetuated over a number of years now that talks about pet collars being found in eagle nests. And after the last time we had it on the show, I had reached out to our retired wildlife biologist that did a lot of work on eagles and ospreys for the state. And his response was that he had never in, I don't remember how many hundreds or thousands of nests that he had visited to band young, had come in contact with a pet collar. And he follows the literature very well as well. So, but this is a case of Dan, you know, with his own eyes seeing this happen. So the question or what usually happens is, you know, how big is the cat? Because an animal, a bird of that size, can only carry so many pounds for any set distance. So perhaps a smaller young cat, you know, quite possibly. And why wouldn't they? I mean, they certainly is a potential prey item. So if you look at YouTube videos and things like that, too, you'll see large eagles, you know, going after deer. And it's hard to say whether that was naturally occurring or if it was a released deer and what the circumstances were for the video. But I think it's possible. I think it's most likely if that animal was able to lift off with the cat, that it was probably a fairly small cat.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Dan, for calling. I appreciate your call. And here's another interesting encounter from Mary and Racine next. Mary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. On the TV on CBS News last week for two nights, they had a story about a goose that was frozen in a pond somewhere in the Milwaukee area, and the DNR wasn't going to do anything about it because it wasn't frozen enough, but the Wisconsin Humane Society was going to go out and see if they couldn't rescue this goose, and the mate seemed to be there, you know, by its side and whatever. And nothing. We've seen nothing. There's been nothing online. I wonder what happened to the goose. Did somebody come and kill it? Did an animal kill it? You know, did it get rescued? Do you by chance know?
Okay.
Hi, Mary. I'm very quickly reading a press release from the Humane Society as our producer, Judith, quickly found some information to help answer your question. So it looks like the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center at the Wisconsin Humane Society released a statement on Saturday, and this occurred in Greenfield with the injured goose that you're talking about. Sounds like there was even another mate and perhaps a young goose involved too, and those two had left on their own. But the director of the rehabilitation center had made an attempt to get out there and rescue that goose, and you know, by the use of food to hopefully coax it. And upon the approach or getting close to it, it sounds like the bird got pretty wary and flew off further into more unsafe conditions for a rescue. So it just says that she was too wary to allow the staff to get close enough to catch her, and she limped. It sounds like she potentially has a broken leg. And she flew out much further onto the ice, and it was too unsafe to follow. So as of today, the two other geese in question had left, and they're hoping to, you know, just get citizen input if they see that other goose again. But I don't know that there's been any recent sightings or really know what happened after that. But they are encouraging people to not go to the park and dump food for the goose, as it may distract her away from bait that they're using to try to capture her. So sounds like, you know, and this is a number of days after the press release. So what's happened since then? I also saw mention of a Facebook page. So you may try looking at the Humane Society Facebook page to see if they have an update, or give the center a call.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Very good. Well, thank you very much for the information. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call. And if there's anybody with an update on it, if you're listening in, if you're from the area,
that's a good idea.
If you know any, if you know anything more, please give us a call or shoot us an email or go to our Facebook page and let us know. Kurt in La Crosse, you are next. Hi, Kurt. Thank you for calling.
Well, good afternoon, or good morning, Larry and David and Jamie. How are you this fine day?
We're
good.
Great.
Great. Say, I have an interesting story. I picked up my dog. He's ailing. He's older. He's 16 years old. And I took him out for a walk. We were gone about 45 minutes. And I came back, and I had a 10-point buck laying in my backyard. I live in La Crosse, Wisconsin. And I live on Main Street, so it's about 6 blocks from the marsh. So the poor deer had to come through across a couple of main streets and run through the campus at UWL, and he just wound up in my backyard. Was never hurt, was never hit by a car or anything, and it was just the most, it was the biggest deer I never shot.
Yeah. What? So you can find no marks. I wonder if it was hit by a car.
Yeah, so... Yeah.
No, I field dressed him and butchered him, and there was not a mark on him.
Why?
Huh, hmm. Interesting.
Well, it is hard to say what happened. I mean, even with a car injury, you could have internal... I mean, was there any
nothing.
Blood pooling? No, everything looked...
Nothing. Well, perfect.
You know, the interesting thing, though, there's, you know... Untold millions of individual wildlife out in the state, and you think about the United States and beyond, it really is amazing that we don't find more dead animals as we're going out and about. And animals die from a whole host of causes, but they also die from natural causes. You know, it could be a heart attack, it could be, you know, high blood pressure, whatever the case might be. And so you may have just, depending on your perspective, gotten very, very lucky to have a deer die in your yard, or very unlucky to have a deer die in your yard. But it probably sounds like it might have just been natural causes.
If that was the case, my wife was very perturbed because she's not a venison eater. I am. And she says, that deer never goes away. however, my 15-year-old dog had quit eating, and he was on his skids out, and... He loves venison and rice.
Well,
there you go.
There you go.
Things happen for a reason, right?
Yeah, there you go.
Interesting.
Good story, Kurt. Thanks a lot for calling. You could post a photo of it on our Facebook page, you know. That'd be kind of fun to see that deer. So if you have a photo, put it up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Love to see it. Thanks again for calling. David in Lake, Wisconsin. Your turn. Hi.
Yeah, hi there. Great program today. Mm-hmm. I heard you talking about the coyotes in the urban areas, and I've heard this before, the growing populations, and the concern with secondary poisonings. I would just, one of your guests could comment, you know, out here in the country, we consider them vermin too. And if we're in the field hunting, we certainly euthanize those creatures at every opportunity we get. I know people think differently, and I just thought you could comment on that.
Yeah, David, that's a good point, and certainly depending on where you live and your experiences, you have different perspectives on things like this. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, coyotes and wolves and fox have a really interesting history here in the United States as well. You go back to Europe as well. and think about that. And a lot of people have grown up with the opinion that these animals are vermin, or they're predators or pests or whatever the case is. You know, look at Elder Leopold's writings in Green Mountain, or Green Fire, excuse me. And so, and then certainly in Wisconsin here, you know, they are, if you're a landowner and you see a coyote that is causing damage on your property, you're allowed to legally shoot that animal or kill it any time of the year. And there are also coyote seasons here in Wisconsin to try to regulate the population a little bit. There was just a story in the news today that California, the Fish and Game Wildlife Agency in California, is trying to ban coyote prized hunts, where they have unlimited harvest out there in California, as they do in many other states. And they have contests to see who can shoot the most coyotes and the biggest coyote and things like that, and you get prizes for it, which is not much different than a bounty system that we used to have here in Wisconsin.
Right.
Up to, I think, 1978 was the last year that counties offered money for the killing of a fox, for example. So you're right. It is a different perspective, and it is a, these animals they're rather prolific breeders. They're a very important animal in the landscape because they do a lot of rodent control and things like that, but they also are very efficient predators, and they kill livestock and chickens. And so if you are in the country and you're trying to raise livestock, you've got a different idea of what a coyote is than somebody who might be in the city.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Yeah, thanks, David, for calling. Appreciate it. Got an email from Steve. This goes back to the deer season. I mentioned the deer season was wrapped up. Well, yeah, the 9-day season, Steve said, did end Sunday, but there's a 4-day antlerless hunt next week in the middle of the state, and a holiday hunt between Christmas and New Year's in the southern part of the state. And he said, please bring this up. I have had issues while hunting on public land during these additional hunts where folks have argued with me that there is no hunt, and have contacted the authorities. What a headache that is.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, this is something that we did want to bring up, that there's still more opportunity if you're looking to harvest a deer. So right now we're in the middle of the muzzleloader season. It'll run through December 10th. That's statewide. The late archery season is also underway and continues until January 4th. And then there is a Central Forest and Central Farmland antlerless hunt that runs from December 11th to the 14th, and a Southern Farmland Zone holiday hunt, which runs from December 24th through January 5th. It's most important that the public, even, you know, really talking about the non-hunting public that are using state parks and properties, public properties, that they become familiar with the various zones. And these are new zones now. So there are 4 zones in the state, and they have different hunting opportunity with different goals. So you'll see more hunting opportunity in the southern and central portion of the state to control the antlerless numbers. So if you go on the Department of Natural Resources website and you use the keyword deer management zones, then you'd be able to see kind of how those dates line up with areas that you're going to visit. And my mom does a lot of walking during the 9-day gun deer season and other seasons. She'll always throw on a piece of blaze orange, and, you know, that's something to be aware of, too. Hunting is safe. It's continuing to get safer. We just talked about that earlier, but it's, just good protocol to throw on some orange and
yep.
If you're going to be out in these public places.
Or even some of that bright yellow now.
Yep.
For hunting, that's not legal,
but certainly any kind of bright coloring, and you have all the right to be on those public places as well.
Yep, there you go. Lila in Madison, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, I was just curious if anyone was monitoring the wolf hunt and looking at problem wolves in heavily hunted areas. And the reason I bring this up is there was a recent article on cougars in Washington, and I know cougars and wolves are very different. But they looked at heavily hunted areas, and what they are starting to think is that mature males that are taken out of the population then have an opening in the landscape for these immature or bachelor males that are coming in, and they're not as, and this is anthropomorphic, but as well-behaved. And they think that perhaps hunting the older males in the cougar populations actually gives these younger males more room and opportunity to be problem animals. Hmm. Is DNR or the university following in this at all with wolves, and do you think it's relevant?
Oh.
Lila, I think these are all questions that will start to get answered as we get further along in the hunting of wolves. So this is our third season. So how this impacts wolf packs, distribution, those sorts of things, we're still playing that out, and to be able to look at those trends. Some pieces of information that I'm, you know, kind of aware of now with the hunt that might help get at that would be, we are seeing since wolf hunting a reduction in the damage or depredation complaints. And again, that's just with 2 years. So they've, you know, currently have had fewer complaints on depredations of livestock and hunting dogs. And additionally, the harvest for wolves, whether that be by trapping or hunting, is primarily made up of pups and yearlings. And only, I want to throw out, like 20 to 30% of the harvest has been adult wolves. Most likely just educated, smarter, if they've encountered a trap before. I know the wolf researchers have said that it's been very rare for them to retrap the same individual adult again, that once they've trapped him once, it's very hard to trap that animal again. So I think some of that will, that information helps, you know, play into what you're observing and reading regarding cougars.
Yeah, the other couple points I'll just add is, you know, cougars are primarily a solitary animal, whereas right. wolves are a pack animal. And so there's a different dynamic there. As well as if you look at some of the wolf range here in Wisconsin, and primarily the northern third or so of the state and then the central forest region, if you go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and just type in wolf map, it's amazing that that entire area is jam-packed with wolves, and there is no space between territories any longer. So the ability for those wolves to move around, like is with the cougars, is probably a little bit more limited. And as Jamie said, more information is going to become available as research is continuing to progress here. And the last thing I'll add is there are government trappers with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and Wildlife Services, and for problem wolves who are recurring problems, especially on livestock farms, that they will go in and target, remove that individual or a couple individuals who are causing the problems, and that usually does alleviate the problems quite effectively and efficiently.
Thanks again for calling. More on wolves, I believe, from Susan in Kearney, Michigan. Susan, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. I like to walk at night or very early morning with my dogs in the woods. And I've seen wolves here, have been seeing them for years. My neighbors have seen them, so I know we have them. I'm just wondering if I need to be concerned about my dogs when I'm out walking.
Susan, I think as long as you are walking, maybe talking to your dogs, you know, you don't want to startle, and we might be talking about bears and wolves and other large animals too, but I think if you're alone, you tend to be fairly quiet, and it doesn't hurt to sing a song or, you know, just let wildlife know that you're there, because more often than not, they're going to go the other way, so you just don't want to startle an animal. And I think, you know, I'm sure you travel with a flashlight and would recommend keeping your dog leashed or at least on a long leash, but next to you. So, yep. David, you have anything
no,
else?
No, I think those are all good suggestions. And the same thing is if for some reason, you know, an animal is coming near you or showing aggression, just make yourself as large as you possibly can, make a lot of noise. If you have something to swing at the animal or throw at the animal, especially toward the face region, you want to do that as well. But again, the more fear of humans you can put in these animals, the safer everybody's going to be, including the animal itself.
Yeah, and the wildlife encounters that we hear about, you know, everybody's heard about bear attacks and things like that. You know, they make national media, so we hear about those attacks, but in reality, those occur very infrequently.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's a very rare occurrence, but it is good to know what to do if you should encounter that situation.
But there's that old joke, though. If you are in an area with high predators, you may want to consider walking with somebody who you know you can outrun on a consistent basis.
That's right.
Thanks for calling, Susan. Appreciate your call. And I did. I have last year, one of our guys from our party was walking out of the woods and from hunting and felt like something was behind him and looked back, and there were two wolves about 20 yards back, and then he looked, and there was one on his right and one on his left. And so at that point,
you feel a little nervous.
Yeah.
Well, he happened to have a rifle with him, and he shot not at the wolves.
Right.
And so a warning shot.
Immediately left.
Yeah.
I had a similar thing walking out from a hunting situation too, and was being paralleled by a black bear that was popping its jaws. And yeah, it makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up a little bit. You walk a little quicker, but you don't run, right? We're all told not to run.
Oh, man. Jen in Mattawa, Minnesota, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yeah, you know, the problem with calling into this show is you end up, when you're listening to the other callers, you have, instead of one thing to say, you've got five things. First of all, there's a YouTube video. This isn't why I called, but there's a YouTube video that your listeners should look up, and I believe the name is, the first name is Mike, but I'm not positive on that, but they could find it if they Googled or if they searched on YouTube for Sasquatch or Bigfoot. And I think his last name is Rooney. But he tells the story of how he heads out to his deer stand. This was over 20 years ago, and he hasn't been able to hunt since. And he's stalked by these two black, large animals, you know, which they are now referring to as Sasquatches. But anyway, that's a really cool video. And the guy is extremely believable, and it's an excellent hunting story. And he goes into great detail about it. So that was pretty cool. And then about walking out in the woods, I have horses, and horses tend to really spook. And when they spook from, you know, a bear or live or just a noise or even just a grouse flushing or something, they'll bolt. And so it's really, really dangerous to be on a horse and have some wildlife just jump out at you. So when I go trail riding on our 40 acres here, I sing. And I sing, you know, I'll sing to the deer. I'll actually sing to the deer, you know, and it's just, it's kind of fun. But the reason I'm calling was a really neat bobcat story. Back on November 11th, my next door neighbor told me the next day that she was leaving for work at 4 a.m. and they heard what they thought was a, she actually said, I think it was a lynx, a wounded lynx. And then she said it was either that or it was a fawn that was injured. And I'm not sure how those two could sound the same. But anyway, that was what she said. So we went out and looked, and I didn't see anything except some fawn tracks headed up the driveway from the road. And so my first thought was maybe one got hit out on the road, and she walked up the driveway, and that's what our neighbor heard. But then 11 days later, I was sitting and looking out, and at about 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, and I saw a cat come by our chicken coop, and our chicken coop is all predator-proof, so I wasn't worried about it. But this cat, at first I thought it was a bobcat, and then it walked on, and I could see it was limping really badly, and I thought it was way too small for a bobcat, so I figured it was just a stray, and I alerted my neighbors and told them to be on the lookout for a limping stray. And then the next day I saw it again, and sure enough, it was a bobcat, and I got a real close-up view of it with my camera and did some videotaping and so forth, and it lost the whole bottom half of its front leg. It was just hanging. It was just, everything was broken. You could see the bones. You could see the tendons and everything hanging there, and it was just hanging by just a little piece, and, you know, it looked like it could break off fairly easily. So I felt so poorly, and we thought, you know, it needs to be euthanized or shot. And so I called a trapper, a guy that does state trapping, and I wanted him to come out and live trap it and then shoot it. And I showed him the video, and the morning that he was going to come out, I just didn't feel right about it. I mean, I knew I wanted the animal not to suffer, but my gut feeling just was, this just isn't right. I don't want to trap this thing. And so I talked to him, and he watched the videos, and he said, I absolutely agree with you. He said, we don't need to end this life. He said, this cat will be just fine. And he's been trapping for 30 years and sounded, you know, very, very knowledgeable about it all. And he gave me a lot of different stories about similar events with other animals. So I started putting food out for it. And it was emaciated. It was just really, really skinny. And so obviously it probably hadn't had a meal since 11 days prior when my neighbor heard it. And so we have horses, and the little cat would come out right not 3 feet from our horse fence. And it was so funny because our horses would come over and they'd arch their neck and their ears would be pricked and they'd watch the cat. And she would go under the drive there into the little culvert where the rabbits would hide out. And so I decided to put the food in there. So I got there's a place down in Minneapolis, Minnesota called, well, it's through Swanson Meats, and it's called Raw's for Paws. It's for people that want to buy the raw food diet for their dogs. And so I bought 85 pounds of raw stuff. We got duck
wings. Oh, my goodness.
Duck wings. Well, I have dogs, too, and they're on the raw diet, so it was okay. But anyway, duck wings and chicken backs and chicken gizzards.
And so to sort of draw this to a conclusion, Jen.
Oh, okay. So anyway, yeah, so I got video of it every single day, super close up, like it was 6 inches from the camera. Beautiful, beautiful video every day. And she fed for 2 weeks, and her paw she would use it a little bit more to dig the food out of the container. And this week was actually the first time that we haven't seen her now for 4 days. I put food out 4 times a day.
Wow. So that's quite the story. Thanks for sharing that with us. And David, comment from you or Jamie?
Well, I'd be remiss not to comment on a few things. So I think she made the right decision not to get involved, right? And in Minnesota, where she's from, I'm not exactly sure on bobcat tags and permits and so on, but it's important to know, especially for Wisconsin residents, that bobcats are highly regulated, both for trapping and hunting, and you need a permit to harvest that animal. So at the point where she was reaching out to get some help, if that person had a tag, that would be no problem. The other option, if somebody finds themselves in this situation, you need to really call the local conservation warden. It's their job to assess the wildlife status, the health of that animal, and decide whether it needs to be removed from the population or not. That being said, there are many, many wildlife that survive with 3 legs, torn ears, different things. So it's amazing how they adapt to live in the wild with injuries. Think about what they're doing, you know, jumping, running, catching animals, chasing prey. I mean, accidents happen in the wild as well. And then I would just, you know, note that feeding that animal, again, we're trying to do good. We really want to help that individual animal. She's made that personal connection with that bobcat, and it's been wonderful to see it as it gets better. But in the long run, if we continue to feed it, it becomes habituated to people that might go next door where there's livestock or chickens that aren't quite as well fortified as her, and becomes a conflict, and ultimately that animal is put down. So I think we just want to be careful about how we intervene and do so in the right means. So contacting a local wildlife biologist or a conservation warden is a good first step when you encounter something like this, and seek their advice as far as feeding and what to do in that situation. But it's a great story, and no doubt she's got some wonderful pictures, and the bobcat is hopefully off and doing really well.
Yeah, appreciate your call very much. Thank you for calling. Talking today with David Drake and Jamie Knack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack, from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. David's also a UW Extension Associate Professor. And great to have them both with us today as we talk about the world of wildlife. You can join in at 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post a question and or wildlife photo on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and we'd love to hear from you. Marcus in Green Bay has a question, so let's go there. Marcus, hi. Thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for the show. One quick question, and then I want to ask maybe your opinion, Larry, and the guests about your opinion, actually. But when you said there was a wildcat at UW Arboretum, did you mean in Green Bay or where?
No, it's at the University of Wisconsin Arboretum here in Madison, and it's it was a bobcat.
Oh, bobcat. Yeah. And then here's my other thing, maybe you can give me your opinions, urban wildlife. So I'm well aware of people have strong opinions on feral cats, and I don't know, I enjoy the wildlife around my apartment. I live in East Green Bay near a Beard Creek Parkway. There's a lot of woods, a lot of wildlife, you know, coming around my apartment. And then they allow pets here and stuff. So a couple of years ago, somebody moved out and left their cat here, and it turned into a feral cat, and it actually has kittens right now, and I know where it's staying outside. It has pretty good shelter. But anyway, my opinion, a feral cat is wildlife, you know, and I just wondered if you guys shared that opinion, or is it, you know, some kind of a pest thing that should be, you know, hated and eliminated? I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, feral cats are typically not considered wildlife. They're a domestic cat that has gone feral, or many instances they're a domestic cat that's not identified with a collar and a tag, and it's somebody's pet. That it could be considered feral if they're on your property because you don't know the cat and you've never seen the cat before. But typically, cats, feral cats or domestic cats, are not considered wildlife at all. You know, there was a big brouhaha a number of years ago at the Conservation Congress where they were trying to allow for the killing of feral cats ad lib, so to speak. So, and feral cats are in the statutes, they are not protected. So if there's a feral cat on your property and it's causing damage at that time, then you are allowed and legal to lethally remove the cat if you wish to. But we always caution people to be very careful about that because there are a lot of people that are very emotional about cats as well as very dedicated to cats. And again, just because the cat doesn't have a collar on or any kind of identification tags, it doesn't not necessarily mean it's feral.
Yeah, that's the other issue. Thanks, Marcus, for calling. Kathy in Oshkosh, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. And Larry, I can remember your saying that feral cats can kill at least 20 songbirds a year. So that's something to consider. But yep. My question regards a field camera. What's a good wildlife camera to set up outside? And how would I? Where should I go to get one?
Good trail cameras. You know? Okay. Well, stay listening here, Kathy. There are, you know, the price on trail cameras has come down considerably, and you can get a pretty good one these days for relatively cheap.
You sure can. You can still spend a lot of money on them, too.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah, so it's like any camera or piece of digital equipment. The more options, the more gadgets, if you want color, if you want to be able to take video, picture quality, all of those things vary quite a bit within the trail cameras. So I think a good starting point for you is to look at some of the outdoor catalogs, sportsmen, sportsmen and women, you know, businesses, places of operation that you can go and start pricing them out and looking at those features. The other thing that I would do is go online and just do a search for trail camera reviews. Obviously, as us as state employees, we can't recommend models and manufacturers and where to go and things like that. But I would definitely go to the website, see what people are using and what they like, and then think about how much money, you know, you would want to invest on it. You can get a pretty good camera for $100. And as David said, you can spend some of the ones that we're using in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology are $300 to $400. And that's because they're being used for science. We can't afford mistakes, malfunctions. We need every photo of every animal we can possibly get to be complete in the data. So quite a range. And I think the internet will be a very good starting point as you start to assess what one is right for you.
Yeah, there you go.
But it is a wonderful tool out there to have, and more people are using them. And, you know, the Department of Natural Resources, they have a place where you can actually upload the pictures, and they are teaming up with some professors in our department, and they're actually doing a project on identification of wildlife through cameras across the state. And the DNR is also going to be, I think, putting out 6,000 cameras, if I remember the number correctly,
yeah,
across the state here pretty soon. So they are using them not just for recreational, not just for aesthetics, but also for a lot of research purposes.
Yeah, pretty cool. Although I will have to say that I had a friend lose a camera, and he had it in the middle of the Shawamigan National Forest and never thought anybody would find it to take it, and somebody found it and dug it.
Yep, yeah. They get stolen, and they also get destroyed by bears and all sorts of other things going on.
Yeah, so you really got to think about how much money you want to put into it and or at least take precautions to lock it up.
Yeah, thanks again for calling, Kathy. I hope that helped. And Richard in Madison. Hi, Richard. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thanks for the program on wildlife. While listening, I heard about the various deer seasons. what puzzles me is years ago on this program, Scott Craven was very concerned about chronic wasting disease. And I haven't heard much about that lately. And I was wondering if you could explain why the concern just seemed to disappear.
I don't think it disappeared.
No,
yeah, the concern is still there. You know, we had a Dear Trustee report, a long story, but it was a panel of three outside experts that evaluated the Wisconsin Deer Management Program, and that was one of many, many, many different aspects of that program that were evaluated. And long story short, that report had looked at public input as well from hunters, landowners, general public, and so on. And CWD was one of those topics. And the decision, the outcome of that report regarding CWD was actually to dissolve the management zone. However, that area where CWD exists and is present today is called the CWD affected area. And as of 2014, the disease has been detected in wild deer in 18 counties in the state. So it is, you know, spreading slowly, but it's affecting spreading. 18 of our counties. Currently, the state has taken a kind of monitor the spread and prevalence of CWD approach and publishing that information so the public is aware of it and can see all of those results. So currently the state is testing about 8,000 wild deer annually for the disease and other diseases. Yep.
You know what? We'll probably, we've got a lot more to talk about relating to that, and I definitely want to get that in. We're going to take a quick look at the news, weather. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back. Jamie will have more to say about CWD. Stay with us. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You know, we have an amazing treasure of wildlife here in the state of Wisconsin, and whether you're new to wildlife watching or you've been doing it a long time, it's always great to talk and learn, talk about our wildlife and learn more about them. And so glad to have David Drake and Jamie Knack with us. Jamie's a wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Jamie, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
And David Drake, wildlife specialist with UW Extension, associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW. Great to have you back, David.
Thank you.
And great to have you listening in. And as you listen in, you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. We had a question from Richard in Madison about CWD, and Jamie, you were talking a bit about that. I know you had a few more things that you wanted to mention in relation to
You know, the strategy or, you know, the disease is still present, and it's being monitored closely by the DNR. There is no longer a zone, a CWD management zone. Instead, the area where CWD occurs is referred to as a CWD-affected area. So, as I mentioned, the state is going to a monitoring the prevalence and the spread of the disease, and they're doing that through testing about 8,000 deer annually for the disease. There are still the same restrictions on baiting and feeding that are you cannot bait or feed in those CWD-affected areas. Similar hunting seasons are offered in the CWD-affected areas as elsewhere in the state. And again, the future efforts around CWD will be research focusing on detecting and preventing the spread and then making that information readily available to the public. So if Richard wants to kind of get a summary on chronic wasting disease, where we're at currently, again, the Department of Natural Resources website, type in CWD and you'll see all the current prevalence maps and can follow the testing as we test the deer from this 9-day gun deer season.
Yeah, it's interesting. You wonder if there's actually any way that you're ever going to stop this.
Well, we look at some of the states, you know, out west, Colorado, Wyoming, that have been dealing with it for a very long time, and that's really where they're at. Hunters continue to hunt. They have their deer tested, and, you know, we monitor the prevalence of where, you know, what the prevalence rate is and then where the disease is located. But it's difficult.
Yep.
I want to go back to an earlier caller. Jen had called about feeding a bobcat, and she has followed up since then and posted on our Facebook page a couple of actually a video and another still picture, I think, at least of that bobcat. So you can, if you want to see what that bobcat looked like, you it's up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. So certainly if you'd like to do that, please do. Or maybe you've got a photo of your own or a video. You can join in to put it up on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. You can also email us a question at talk@WPR.org, or you can call us. In fact, we have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Marlis in Cambridge, thank you so much for calling. Hi.
Hello. I just had a question about raccoons. I've lived in Wisconsin for more than 40 years. I've driven mostly, you know, through the back roads, Highway 73, Highway 12 and 18, and so on. I have never seen as many dead raccoons on the side of the road as I saw this past spring and summer. I wondered, did they all have distemper, or what happened? How could there have been? Sometimes between Cambridge and Jefferson, I would see five dead raccoons in a span of not much more than 10 miles. I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Hi, Marlis. You know, raccoons are a very common animal throughout the state and throughout rural versus urban, as well as urban areas. And, you know, their populations can fluctuate a little bit. It may have just been a very good year for them, and perhaps they had higher recruitment in terms of reproduction than in previous years. You know, we do see these pulses of roadkill with raccoons or possum or skunk when the young are starting to move out of their natal or the territory or habitat where they were raised, and they kind of get pushed out by the females. And you know, it's like a teenage driver that they're trying to navigate this new landscape to them, and they don't always pay attention to what they're doing. So that's a possibility. My guess is, since you saw them along the roadside, that there's probably nothing wrong with them other than they were just unlucky to come in contact with the vehicle, and that was it. But, you know, raccoons, they carry a lot of different diseases, and we don't have, thankfully, we don't have raccoon rabies here. It's further out east in the United States, but, you know, rabies is an issue, parvo is an issue, some other diseases. There's some, you know, ringworm, some issues, things like that. So it is probably just that they may have had a good recruitment year. You may have been paying more attention than you do normally in other years, and, you know, who knows. But I've not had reports that there's a higher number of raccoons than usual.
Thank you again for calling, Marlis. Appreciate your call. You know, earlier we were talking about a wildlife camera, and you know, that's a great Christmas gift or Hanukkah gift, perhaps. It's a holiday giving time. Camera's great. What other things can you guys suggest that are in the wildlife area?
Yeah, I mean, we can throw out a whole bunch of possibilities for sure. But in terms of wildlife or somebody who loves the Wisconsin's natural resources, a state park pass mm-hmm. would be a good one. They are about $25 for a Wisconsin license plate. I think there is a break for senior citizens on that as well. A subscription to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources magazine
mm-hmm.
Or other magazines or organizations like either a membership, which often includes a magazine. So it could be the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology.
Great group.
Yeah National Audubon Society.
I mean, Pheasants Forever, Whitetails Unlimited, you know.
Yep.
Resources Foundation is another great one.
Absolutely.
Yep, you could make a contribution in somebody's name as a gift. Other things from bird feeders to bird baths or gift certificates for you know, businesses that sell those items. A bat house mm-hmm. is a possibility. David, you have some...
Yeah, you know, wildlife identification guides, binoculars is a possibility. You know, they're always trying to recruit new hunters and things like that. So if you have an interest in hunting, you could buy somebody, you know, perhaps a rifle or a shotgun or a bow, fishing rod, fishing tackle, things like that. And even though this is, you know, we're talking about the holiday season and this should occur year round, but take somebody out in the wild with you and, you know, maybe give them some of your time to take them out bird watching or hiking or camping or fishing or hunting or trapping or whatever the case is. But, you know, get the kids outside, as we talked about earlier in the program with that nature deficit disorder. We need to get a lot more people reintroduced to the outdoor world than is currently the case.
Absolutely.
Well, and I know my children are hopefully not listening. They should be in school so I can squeal on what their gifts are. But, you know, they're getting bug nets and, you know, butterfly catchers and holders. And Insect Lore is a company you can get
there's some kids
larvae from and watch, you know, butterflies hatch and let them go. So, you know, think of things that, yeah, we can't do it in January, but would be nice gifts to get kids involved in. And there's field guides for children as well. So
yeah, and other wildlife books as well. So
yeah.
Very, very good ideas as we go on. You know, one other one, we did talk about bird feeders, but I actually gave some bird seed as gifts to a couple different people who I know are who do a lot of feeding. And
and if they're used to doing that and paying for it, they know how valuable
expensive.
Of a gift that is.
It is expensive.
Yes. Kevin in Gays Mills has a question. Hi, Kevin. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thank you for letting me be on the program. I kind of got a question and kind of like a story to share. First, I'll start with my story. I was working one day with some coworkers and everything, and we were on our way out to a site, and we happened to see a coyote walking down the middle of the road, and it had like a, what would you say, it's like a cat food jug on his head, like it tried to get the morsels, like in the bottom corner, and the guy I was riding with, we stopped, and we got out, and, you know, we looked at the coyote, and we were like, okay, whenever you're ready, and, you know, we pulled on the jug, and he pulled his head out, and, you know, he took off running. That was unbelievable. I just thought it was cool. And I have a comment about, I watched a documentary lately, and, you know, a wildlife documentary, and it was based on what they call a coy wolf, like almost like a mix between, like, a coyote and wolf. And I was just wondering what your guys' comment on was it. You know about it, and if we have anything to worry about it, and I will take my answer off the air.
Thanks. All right, thanks a lot, Kevin.
Well, Kevin, thank you very much for helping the coyote with the jug on its head. Hopefully, it would have gotten it off anyway, but it's always nice to do something good like that. So, the coy wolf question is a recurring question on Larry's show here, and so typically, that is more of an eastern United States phenomena than it is here in the Midwest, and specifically in Wisconsin. There may be some coy dog crosses, for example, here in Wisconsin, especially up on the Indian reservations and things like that, or some of the more rural parts of our state. But we don't really have coy wolf crosses that have been documented here in Wisconsin.
And I probably not, you know, they don't get along very well.
Typically, yeah, so that's another good point, Larry. Wild canids, so wolves, coyotes, and fox, they are predators upon each other. So if the wolf is the top predator, and a wolf, if it can catch a coyote or a fox, typically it will kill that animal, partly because it's trying to remove a competitor, but also partly for food. And then a coyote, if it can catch either a gray or a red fox, it will kill that fox. And again, for the same reason that the wolf is killing coyotes and fox. So, yeah, typically that's the other issue is that instead of breeding, they're more likely to kill you than they are to breed you.
We had a post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, a photo Bill took of a snowy owl. Can we hope to see an eruption this year again?
Well, there are so far 31 snowy owls that have been documented in Wisconsin this year. And which is pretty neat. Last year, it was a phenomenal year for snowy owls coming into the state of Wisconsin. And so last year, in November, roughly, they had 2 documented snowy owls. We've already had 31. So there's not sure if this is going to be a record year like it was last year or not, but it sure is neat seeing them. And it got a lot of people very excited last year. And there's a couple of things maybe, Larry, if we have a minute or two just to report on. So one of the things that occurred last year with this big eruption of snowy owls into Wisconsin and other parts of the northern parts of the United States is some researchers took the opportunity to actually radio some of the snowy owls that they caught, and they put what's called a backpack harness on these animals. So they hold the radio onto the back of the snowy owl with a harness that goes around the wings. The animal is still able to fly and move and act normal and things like that, but the radio is on a cell phone platform instead of like a VHF or a satellite-type radio. And they found in the last year or so, they found some really interesting information, and not much was known about snowy owls because they're rather solitary. They're nocturnal. They can be diurnal as well. But one of the things they found on some of these radioed owls is some of the owls are staying within a mile or so where they were radioed. Other owls moved hundreds of miles over a couple of weeks. And so that was really interesting to see the disparity of movement. But the other interesting thing is that these owls, there was always a suspicion that, snowy owls eat a lot of birds in the wintertime. And one of the thoughts about why they come south is because they're following the food base, the lemmings. But what they found out is that the owls are spending a lot of time eating ducks, geese, other birds like that. And some of these owls are spending weeks and sometimes months out in the middle of the frozen Great Lakes and are just living out there full-time and eating ducks that are existing in the ice breaks or ice leads on the Great Lakes. And so that was really interesting.
Wow.
And the last thing I'll mention quickly, this gets back a little bit to some of the things we talked about early on about urban wildlife. But the other thing they found out is when they found a dead owl, they would collect it and necropsy it, which is an animal autopsy. And one of the things they found by looking at tissue samples is that these owls are dying from a whole host of reasons. But one of the reasons is rodenticide poisoning. And so they are eating the rodents, and they are also ingesting that rodenticide. And that's one of the things that's killing these owls. So we want to be careful about that. You know, rodenticides are a very important tool out there, but if you do use them, make sure you collect the carcass of the animal that you're killing using the rodenticide.
Oh, boy, that's...
But keep your eyes open. The snowy owls are coming back.
Where are we going to see them?
So far, they seems like they're in most of the regions of Wisconsin, but they seem to be concentrated in the southern and the eastern quadrants of Wisconsin so far. But that's based on citizen science reports. And so just because if you go to the map on eBird for Wisconsin and you don't see a location for snowy owl, doesn't mean it's not there. It just means somebody hasn't seen it and reported it in that location so far.
And I think if I recall, the southernmost counties have been Columbia County and Dodge County. So it's likely they'll, I mean, that's kind of where they're at now. But as we progress through the winter, we might see them even further south and into Dane County.
Yep.
There we go. Bob and Stevens Point, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Hey, I love your owl stories. That's fantastic. I got a quick story for you, and then I got a question. A couple of years ago, one of my neighbors shot the local fox just because he thought it was vermin. And then that same winter, we lost 200 trees that we had planted where the voles girdled them all. Now, normally the fox would eat the voles, and the problem, maybe I'd lose 5 or 10 of those trees. But anyway, the fox are very valuable creatures, and so are the coyotes, if you like trees, because the small rodents will destroy the small trees. These were like 5-year-old red pines that we lost. Anyway, that's a story. The question I got for you, we had 6 wounded deer last year on my place on 80 acres, and they're all shot through the legs. My question is, do you think it's one crazy person shooting them or 6 guys that can't shoot straight?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good question. And the fact that he has 6 on the property over winter, you know, maybe they are yarding up or grouping up on his property over the winter. So, you know, during the deer season, if this was something that was occurring during the hunting season, which we don't necessarily know for sure, it could be hit by a car or just, you know, an injury, natural injury. But those could be coming from a variety of areas into that his property where they're overwintering. So it's really hard to say. I mean, unfortunately, there are bad apples out there that do illegal activities, but there's a lot of other means that may have happened. So I really can't hazard a guess over the exact cause of those injuries and the fact that there were so many that you noticed on the property. But they are pretty resilient. I'm sure you've watched that as well, too, and how they've handled getting through the winter and dealt with those injuries.
Yep, absolutely. Bob, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. And I want to give Robin and Arena a chance to join us. Hi, Robin.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a comment for the gentleman in Green Bay who was commenting on a feral cat with kittens. At least in Dane County here, we have several programs that assist with feral cats and the capture and medical treatment of feral cats. So I would suggest to him to contact his local Humane Society and see if they might come out and live trap this cat and her kittens. I know from Friends of Ferals here in Dane County, I adopted 2 kittens from them, and they're the most wonderful cats I've ever had.
Oh, okay, excellent.
That would be my suggestion to him.
Thank you very much for calling. And they will also, they often will re-release, but they will, I was going to say euthanize, but not euthanize. Yeah. They will
spay and neuter and release. Yeah. So it prevents the cats from reproducing, but the cats are still an efficient predator in the landscape, even though they have been reproductively controlled.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Robin. That is a very good point to bring up. Mike and Ladysmith, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. You know, I've had a number of concerns, which I won't go into all of them, about the new deer plan after the three gentlemen have weighed in and written a report. But one of the things I'm concerned about is what I perceive to be a bias towards the hunting side of it. And I'm a deer hunter. I'm all for that. But the also a forest land owner where, you know, we try to raise trees to harvest. And one of the concerns I have is there doesn't appear to be a significant discussion or in my eyes, there appears to be a bias against, raising more deer when that's going to have a browse problem for those of us that are trying to also raise trees.
That's a good point. A comment from you, David?
The only thing I'll mention, Mike, and Jamie may also have something to say, is I know when they were doing public comment for the Deer Trustee report that they did take into effect the county forest councils. Dr. Kroll, who was the primary author of the report, he stressed a lot about looking at deer habitat and the health of that habitat as well, including over-browsing. And so there is a good amount of effort and attention focused on that, Mike, and it is a real concern. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for calling. Kay wondered, who lives in north of Ladysmith, seeing bear tracks in her driveway, aren't they supposed to be hibernating at this time of year? Looks like a younger bear by the size of the paw prints.
Yeah, typically bears would be, by end of October, especially the further north you go, they are going to be hibernating, but it's not uncommon for them to arouse, do walkabouts, stretch their legs, and go right back into hibernation. I can remember deer hunting a number of years ago in Price County, so that's, third week of November, and coming across bear tracks and thinking, that bear's probably hungry if it's up walking around, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's not uncommon, but, yeah, typically they are hibernating during this time.
And when they're hibernating, they're not necessarily in deep in some big cave.
Times it might be what you would call a windfall or a tip over. So a tree that has fallen and you've got that big root structure, they might just dig out the little bit of dirt there or go underneath a brush pile and dig out enough and just really be fairly shallow in the depth of the den.
Yep, they hibernate underneath people's porches sometimes.
And culverts.
Yeah, culverts and all sorts of places like that.
And we actually saw one in northern Wisconsin that was kind of part of its back was just still sticking out.
Yeah.
It wasn't even, it was still
completely
exposed.
Completely covered.
Right. Yeah, it wasn't completely covered.
Yep.
So. Wow, we have lots of good things to talk about. You guys will come back and be with us again, I hope.
Absolutely.
All right. Look forward to that. David Drake and J.V. Knack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. We'll be back again. We'll talk some more with them about wildlife in Wisconsin. Tomorrow at 11, we'll learn about the difficulty of dealing with difficult people during the holidays, how to do that. And then we'll talk about talk with Timothy Shriver. He's going to be talking about his career with the Special Olympics. It's a great book that he has. Thank you for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.